Good afternoon, everyone. Those of you who might take your seats and we'll get underway. My name is Megan Lloyd. I'm the editor of the Sunday Mail and president of the SA Press Club, and I welcome you all here today to what has become a bit of a tradition for us in the Tour Down Under week to have... I think this is the second time we've had both Phil and Paul, but Phil has certainly been here, I think, 4 or 5 years now, so that certainly is a press club tradition. I don't think we've had too many people back that often, but judging by the turnout and the enthusiasm that was in certainly in the foyer, there's a reason for that. We'll be having lunch shortly, and then I'll be inviting Phil and Paul to talk to us today. I'd just like to acknowledge a few other people that are here today. First of all, I'd like to welcome Stuart Bates from Telstra, Telstra's Regional Services Director. Telstra are a great sponsor of the Press Club, and we welcome you. Yes. The Honourable Isabel Redman, Leader of the Opposition. And, of course, all of our interstate cycling enthusiasts that are here today. We've got people here from... not just South Australia, but also from interstate. And I think the furthest away we have people here today is Mackay in Queensland. So welcome to you. Today you'll be enjoying wines from Jacobs Creek, of course, and beers from SA Brewing, and we thank both of those sponsors. I remind you that we have a raffle, 3 tickets for $5. And, of course, our prizes are our $300 voucher from Jeff Timms Jewellers. We also have some wine, James Bogues, today. Thank you to SA Brewing. We also have a couple of bottles of Jacobs Creek as a pack, and also an RM Williams tote bag, shopping bag, marker bag, whatever you like to call it, which is thank you to RM Williams. I will be back shortly, as I said, to welcome our guests. And I'd just like to mention to those of you who are regular SA Press Club attendees to our lunches that we actually do have Isabel Redman, who is the Leader of the Opposition, who will be joining us in March. I think it's March the 16th from memory. Thank you. So certainly book for that. But thank you, and I'll see you shortly. Thank you, everyone. I hope you enjoyed your main course. I'd like to introduce our guest speakers today. I just, if those of you maybe not familiar with the format, Paul and Phil are actually going to sit here today quite comfortably on a couple of armchairs and basically have a chat to us. And at the end of it, we'll invite questions, as we usually do. If I could ask that anyone from the media would just take a little bit of priority, but anyone here is more than welcome to get up and ask a question of our speakers today. The combined knowledge of cycling, I guess, of Phil and Paul is simply immense, and their passion and enthusiasm is infectious for all of us who are their viewers and listeners. When I was standing out with Phil earlier, one of his fans came up to talk to him, and it was, you know, it's a pleasure to actually just observe and that enthusiasm and that passion that you encourage and instill in people. In other years, we've had the pleasure of hearing Phil and Paul talk not just about our event, the Tour Down Under, but also usually they give us a fairly in-depth or certainly their reflections on the previous year's Tour de France. And more often than not, those talks have often spent, we've spent quite a bit of time hearing about them talking about Lance Armstrong, who, of course, came out here and competed several times. This year, I know a lot of us are looking forward to hearing about their accounts of Cadel Evans winning last year's Tour de France. For those people who are into cycling and into sport and into news, it really was the most amazing success and event for us and win. Something that I think a lot of people who have been following the Tour de France in this country for a long time have been looking forward to. And, of course, we've got the birth of Australia's first professional cycling team, Green Edge, which I think if everybody's on board, as there seems to be, we're all expecting them to win the Tour immediately this year and the Giro and everything else, and we might need to be calmed down a little bit and told we must wait our turn. But, you know, if they could win on enthusiasm alone, I think Green Edge will certainly win a lot in the coming year. I'm sure you're all familiar with the bios of Phil and Paul, but just to recap, Phil Liggett was a former amateur cyclist who chose to concentrate on sports journalism. Paul Sherwin was a professional cyclist who also took part in seven tours. They are a sought-after commentary team all over the world. We were just discussing earlier, not only do we normally get to hear them, of course, on SBS here, but Channel 9 now, but for this tour event anyway, they've previously worked, of course, for the US cable, they have worked for the US cable network Versus, which I've just learnt today is now called NBC. It's still a cable network. I actually had the experience of hearing them watching it from the Versus side this last northern summer when I was watching the tour when I was overseas. And in the past, they've just talked about how they juggle the different, especially with the tour, how you switch from one broadcast network to another and it's seamless, and we at home don't seem to know that. And so having aware of that, sitting, you know, in Toronto as I was watching Versus and hearing them on that, and I was thinking, I wonder what they're getting at home at this bit now, because I know they're talking to me on Versus and, you know, they're not going to be talking to everybody else on SBS. So that insight from previous years certainly added to my enjoyment of the tour last year. Paul lives in Uganda, where he has interests in mining, and we've heard Phil in the past talk about living in South Africa as well as England. Enough of me, Phil Liggett and Paul Sherwin.
Well, I see you recognising age now, putting us on settees here.
Yeah, Phil, I was actually just looking for your slippers. And somebody left the pipe, so
these,
you could bring the slippers and the pipe up.
These talks aren't rehearsed, by the way. It's lovely to be back. We seem to have become a permanent fixture. Paul's joined me now as a permanent fixture. Let me just tell you that last night he fell asleep during commentary because he was jet-lagged from Uganda. You can tell the story about the visa if you want to, but the producer said to me, he said, right, guys, we're going in five. And I said, it'll be just me, Paul's asleep. And he was... But he's all right today, aren't you?
It was a lot of fun, actually, because I know you've got to get an electronic visa to come to Australia. It normally works exceptionally well. So I filled out the electronic form, and I got a response back. We'll be processing your visa. And then 2 days later, I got a form saying, you've already got a visa, so if we continue with the process of renewing your visa, we'll cancel the previous one. And I wrote back and said, carry on and go ahead. But unfortunately, my visa was valid right until the 12th. And I actually left on the 12th, and the new one didn't come till the 13th. And the gentleman at the Entebbe Airport said, well, you can't leave on this visa because you're going to arrive in Australia tomorrow. And I said, but a visa for the 13th will arrive overnight. Well, I said, I'm still very sorry, you can't get on this plane. And I didn't get on the plane. I went home and had dinner with the wife. I took her out for lunch the next day, so I got an extra 24 hours at home. But it did mean that I actually only arrived yesterday morning. So, Phil, thank you very much for closing the show last night.
Brilliant. Brilliant. I had a sleepless night thinking about that. At least you're here. How times have changed. We were just talking on our table here that people now, when I was trained as a journalist, journalists just never did any sport. The most unfit people in the world. My work, I'm speaking only of sports journalists. They're always fat, they always smoke fags. I remember on the Tour de France in 1975 maybe, a guy came up to me and said, why aren't you like all the other journalists? I said, what do you mean? He said, well, look at them. They're smoking Galois, they're all fat, they're typing with one finger. I said, well, I was a cyclist. He said, oh, I explained it. But now, everybody is riding bikes. It was like the rush hour in Henley's Beach this morning when I was on the bike, 100 going that way, 100 going that way. Eddie Merckx went that way with Pat Yonker. Couldn't keep up with it all. It's absolutely fantastic how times have changed. I was only talking to a CEO yesterday, and he says, well, the 19th hole now on the golf course is actually Lycra. And if the guys don't want to come out with me and talk about business, then we don't talk about business. That's how times have changed. Well, Paul, we had a good year, didn't we? We always have a good year. We're still alive.
Well, I think definitely. I think last year we were amazed that Cadel Evans had been the first Australian ever to be a world champion, world professional road racing champion, that is. Mm. And we always thought that, you know, was he going to be the eternal hope? Was he going to always be almost a Tour de France winner? I think last year everything was perfect. The team was perfect. Mm. And somebody at the table was saying, well, you know, Cadel got the individual victory. He got the individual glory. But it was the whole team that was behind him. All of those guys sacrificed himself. But there was always the one moment when, if you're going to be a great leader, you have to take over, you have to assume the role of leader, despite having a great team behind you. And I think that was on the day that Andy Schleck took off, because that was a very brave move. That could have won the Tour de France for Andy Schleck.
Yep.
But in fact, it turned it around, and it won it for Cadel Evans.
Absolutely right. At the finish on the Champs-Élysées, I had to get out of the commentary box somehow and try and get in amongst the crowd because SBS and the world wanted a quick quote off the winner. It's not easy because normally I don't do that sort of stuff. I let Paul, the younger man, rush around and fight the journalists and push cameras out of the way. But I finally got down to him, and the guys with me said, the camera's on, just get the mic in there. So I said, you know, congratulations, Cadel, you've done it. And he looked at me and he started to cry. I need to start to cry as well. He said, you told me I could win the Tour de France. In 1998 on Mount Wellington in Hobart, you told me I could win the Tour. I said, well, thank God, I'm not used to telling lies. And he was just so good. He was animated because anybody that knows Cadel, I think he comes over in his interviews, he's a very introverted character. He would prefer not to be there, but I'll tell you, when he came home to Federation Square, I think the figure was like 80,000 people. Well, there were 112,000 last night, but 80,000 just to see Cadel come home. You can imagine, he couldn't believe they'd come to see him. And that's happened to a number of cyclists over the years, that we've seen the welcomes they've got. Nobody realizes the pull of the Tour de France. Paul told me last night that we're doing a film now on the Chateau of France. I've heard about it, by the way, because suddenly the organizer of the Tour de France have realized how many people watch our programs around the world, and we go to 150 countries, for listening about the chateau and the countryside. It's true, isn't it?
No, it certainly is true, and I think that's what we try and pull into the commentary. And I think I said it in one of the local newspapers, the newspapers here. A lot of people, they actually, we don't try and commentate to the cyclists because they reckon they know more than we do anyway. It's actually the little old lady down the street who, this week we're going to talk about Barossa Valley, we're going to talk about McLaren Vale, we're going to talk about the beaches around here. And already today, we've received text messages from the United States, people who were watching the race last night. Mm. They'll be watching South Australia in the States, in Great Britain. And in fact, just as we came out of the hotel today, we bumped into a gentleman from Canada. Mm. And he's been watching this race the last couple of years on Versus in Canada and in the United States, and said, well, why don't I come down here and have a holiday and make a holiday out of it? And that's the one thing I think about the sport of cycling, because it's not a football stadium. It's not an athletics arena. Out there, the beauty of the countryside, whether it's Australia, whether it's South Africa, whether it's Great Britain, the Tour de France, we have got the ability to show something a little bit more than the sport. And we throw a bit of the sport in at the end just to make it exciting when André Greipel crosses the line and beats Green Edge. And that didn't work to perfection, did it?
No. The arrival of Green Edge is absolutely sensational for Australia and for Australian cycling, of course. It's come at the perfect time when cycling has never had a higher profile throughout its history here in Australia. And by the way, this is pretty commonplace with the whole world now as far as the sport and the pastime of cycling goes. Everywhere we go, and I do a lot of work in South Africa, a lot of work in England and Ireland, and of course in America, because they pay them real money. Everybody else is bloody pittance. But anyway, and it's the same attitude. I always know I've been a success when I walk up to immigration and they let me through without worrying about the state of visa, because they recognize me. It's a great relief in Australia, unlike you, of course. Yeah. But I knew there was the Green Edge team was an absolute certainty, because I had the privilege of, last week I stayed for 5 days on Jerry Ryan's ranch. Jerry only stayed for the night, and as he drove off, he thanked me for having put him up for the night. But I was actually staying at the house for another 4 days. But as soon as he didn't serve the Grange, I knew there was a problem with the budget. He'd give it all to the cyclists, and his wine cellar was now going to take a hit. But for Jerry Ryan, he's been unbelievable. I met him through cycling probably 20 years ago when he was just developing. He's made, as we've seen in the papers here this week, $350 million on his Walking with Dinosaurs and stuff. His company, his Jayco Caravan business, which he started him out in life, for his another $350 million turnover a year. He's a very rich man, but he shares his money, and he actually wants cycling to succeed. I've sat with him in China at the Beijing Olympics at dinner, and he's brought half the basketball team around because he sponsors them as well. Now, nobody knows he sponsors them. He just wants to see they have what they want to do, what they want to do best. And he's very much an Australian. So I'm always happy to be in Jerry's company. Actually, he rang up the stables and we got to go and see American. And it's run by, the girl who looks after American is French. Her name is Stephanie. And she's in love with the horse. Absolutely 100% in love with the horse. I'd like to be in love with her. She was a damn good looker, very. But anyway, we went along to the stables. David Haynes has moved all his stables from South Australia now to Victoria, as you may know. And incredible stables. But what was the subject? All the jockeys, all the trainers. David Haynes' son, who's the trainer there at the moment, they just all wanted to talk about cycling. Every one of them, without exception. And they seemed really honored that we'd gone to watch the horses. Well, then we went, and American ran the furlong in something like 13.7 seconds. First time he'd run since he was in his races a while back now. He's been on pasture. And it's just like Eddie Merckx, or a great name like Lance Armstrong. Talent never leaves the body. And this guy, the guy said when he took his lactic test, it was 3.8. It means nothing to me, but it's 3.8, he said. Look at that. He says, now, these other horses, they'd be 12 or 13 on their first run. This thing's ready to race, and this is his first trot round the field. And then it was rather pleasing because John Tavora, who organises the Bay Classic Series, was with me. John has a big stomach, and John was one of Australia's finest cyclists with three Aussie titles, the Commonwealth Games, silver medal, etc. And Stephanie said to John, be careful because the horse bites. So the next thing is, oh! And American had come and bit a big chunk out of his stomach. It was wonderful because he didn't bite me because I had the carrots.
But one thing you mentioned there about American, it's amazing to get the win to win the Melbourne Cup. But it's the 250 other horses you have to buy before you can actually get the winner.
Not in Jerry's case, he only buys one.
And you think, wow, what a lot of money when he won about $15 million when he won the Melbourne Cup.
But not quite,
doesn't
but
buy,
well.
It doesn't buy a lot of hay, does it, really, when you've got to feed 250 horses. Through. And that's a little bit like a professional cycling team. Because we were just talking about Cadel Evans and winning the Tour de France, and you know, can he win it again? We were thinking he was running out of time, because time goes on, doesn't it?
It does.
Eventually, catches up with us all. In fact, I've got to wear glasses full time now. I wasn't doing that 12 months ago. But somebody asked me about the Tour de France route this year, and I thought that was it. Cadel had won the Tour de France. That was it. That was finished. I didn't think he would be able to win it a second time because of time marching up on his career. But when you look at the route for next year, he might not be riding for Green Edge, but let's never forget he is an Australian. I reckon he's got a pretty good crack of making it too.
And his BMC team has really got behind him and strengthened the team for this year. They spent a lot of money. I don't know where they got the money from, but they spent an awful lot of money. And I really think Cadel will be a podium finisher in July. I wouldn't like to say a win, but I'd be very surprised. I wouldn't be surprised if he won the race. There's a lot of time trials, and that's rather hit Andy Schleck in the stomach, really. Andy can't ride a time trial. And do you remember that last time trial on the Saturday? I mean, the whole of Australia was watching. Again, when it was in Victoria, somebody said, because you all have to be insomniacs, I know, to watch the tour to the bitter end every night. But the girl said to me, we looked out of our house window in the street at 2 o'clock in the morning, and every light was on, every light. Everybody was watching Cadel in the time trial. You could see by his body language, because we didn't get time checks for a while, he was absolutely flying from the minute he dropped out the start house. It was just fantastic. And I felt sorry for Andy, because you could clearly see, too, that Andy had locked up and he wasn't getting it out at all. Cadel, though, that day became the Tour champion. The next day was just a happy ride to Paris, as it always is, when you've got the final yellow jersey. And I think, like Stephen Roach in the old days, when Stephen also won the Tour in 87, you don't realise what you've achieved, because sportsmen never realise what they achieve. It's the others who make them the superstars they are, because to them it's just a progression in their sport, which they're very good at. I mean, Paul was just happy if he saw Paris in the Tour de France. I mean, And that was an achievement in itself, really, wasn't it?
It's bloody difficult nowadays because you can't find the petrol half of the time. But it was actually quite nice for the lady president to mention actually seeing the other verses or version of the television program that we do, because even Channel 9 this week, everybody's seen the performance that we do on Channel 9. But what you don't realize is when Channel 9 goes to the advert breaks, we've actually got to keep coming back and talking. And in the Tour de France, it's quite strange because they have this, just to explain how it actually happens, Phil and I commentate
this
side
by
side.
Story. I'm going to sit down.
You have a seat.
We may as well make use of it.
Yeah, that's an excellent idea. They actually have a soundproof board, and Phil, as you said, has to go and we do a lot of inserts into the American broadcast because they want to do the profiles of the riders and they want to do the statistics of the Tour de France. So we end up commentating together. Then they put this big board between us, and then I'm talking to SBS for about 10 minutes while Phil gets all the accolades from the American TV. And then we come back and we start talking together. And it's not a very easy thing to do because I don't know what he's been talking about, and he doesn't know what I've been talking about, and we seem to pull it off.
Well, if you occasionally hear us say the same thing within seconds, it means we both, the board just disappeared. And now everybody's hearing, because we have a light system. It says versus, red light. The other light says the world. And when they're both on, of course, everybody's hearing us. But it sounds a simple system. But, you know, 2 hours down the road now, you've been working flat out. Notes are flying everywhere. The computers are telling us. They're getting French commentary in our ears from the radio tour. And then I slip Paul a note again saying, who the hell are we talking to? Because we don't want to tell a story, say, about Lance Armstrong necessarily to the South African audience. We want to tell them about Robbie Hunter, who's riding this race here, by the way. But he's a South African stage winner. And that they'd be interested to know. We don't want to tell about Robbie to somewhere in America. We reach 150 countries, they tell us, but there's only 4 countries who actually get our non-stop flow of commentary. It's SBS here, it's Mnet in South Africa, which is called Supersport, and the big pairs are America, so they get everything, and if they say something, we have to do it, and ITV in Britain, who cut into everything. And we're always heard by Versus, whatever goes on, and the rest we cut in and out. Versus is called Outdoor Life in Canada, and it's only the Tour de France they show on that network now. And, of course, the Canadians write and think it's our fault when they can't get the one-day classic races, for example. I'm already getting the Twitters now, or tweets, whatever they call them, complaining about the scheduled time this week on the television with Channel 9. And they think I can do something about it. I'd love to do something about it. It means I'd be home in bed earlier.
Yeah, but I think you're getting all the positive tweets about the fact that it's going to be live on Saturday and Sunday.
It is live on Saturday and Sunday, but, you know, cyclists have never been satisfied since I've ever been a commentator. They want more and they want more, and but the weekend will be sensational. This has got a lovely flavour about it this year, the race. The riders now accept the Tour Down Under as being part of the annual calendar. Greipel, who started off with a win last night, he loves coming here, and he says he's coming out a month earlier next year because he wants to ride over in Victoria and get his legs even fresher. I don't know if you noticed the size of his thighs on television last night, but two of those in a forest, and we'll be in trouble.
Well, if Greipel wants to come out a month earlier, I'd better give him a bit of advice on how to make sure he gets his e-visitor done a little bit more easily.
Yeah. We can talk forever on the tours, you know. We can talk forever on anything. I'll tell you a quick story about the Chateau, simply because it's quite amusing. People think we are absolutely unbelievably brilliant with our knowledge of France.
Hey,
shouldn't tell them.
No.
Well, don't let it go out this room, least of all to the newspapers. But about 5 years ago, we found a lady who writes the book, albeit in French, on the Tour de France. And the French didn't realize they had something to sell. It's amazing, but a country like France had this great race all these years. They just didn't realize they could sell their country by putting a race on. It didn't take long for South Australia to twig on. They were doing it from day one when the Prem was John Olsen. But no, not France. That's their race. It's in Chern, you know. So we got the book. And nowadays, this book is now delivered to us at the start every day in French and English. But the interpretation's a bit weak, so we always like to stick with the French one. But we're not in the hands of the television pictures because, like here, the host is Channel 9, but there the host is French television and we can't control where the cameras go. So, but we do at least know the stage we're on, and this book is segmented into stages. And they put pictures in of these chateaux. And occasionally, they put a little camera, television camera, by the picture, which means the helicopter's been instructed to find that chateau. Yeah, well, he never gets his facts right, because it's often he pops up and the chateau's not the same as the picture we've got. And now, we're going like this with the book. But I usually leave all this to Paul. I have actually made Paul one of the most brilliant architects and knowledgeable persons of France. And I say, right, well, look at that one, Paul. That needs a bit of renovation, looks like. It might be Louis the 17th. And he's going... I can see the pages flying through, and I'm just like... And then,
Thanks, Phil.
We usually, but we usually have to recognise whether it's got two keeps, three towers, four spires. There's a car parked out back. It's all in the pictures when we eventually get to the right page. But you will not believe the people who write to us and comment on the fact that they love the chateau. They really do.
No, and that's why I had to share this with Phil yesterday. The French have decided to do a 90-minute DVD coming up very shortly, which will be a history of the Tour de France. Some of the old black and white footage, which Phil remembers, and he's going to do the historical part. and I'm going to do a little bit about the chateaus and the history of the chateaus, so that should be coming out during the course of the year.
Yes, well, I'm glad to hear, and the same price applies, nothing. But anyway, is there any questions you'd like us to direct our attention to? Once you ask me one question, it could be another hour before you finish the answer to it, but did I see any hands go up, or do you want me to keep talking? Oh, off you go. Well, it's a great question, and I could talk for an hour on this, as could Paul, because we both love Africa. Paul lives in Uganda. He's chairman of the mines in Uganda. I've never made a penny out of the gold mine, but he's in charge of it. And
and mind you haven't lost a penny either.
Well, I have.
Yes.
I've got two properties in South Africa, including a very big farm inside the wild part in the Kruger Park. So, and we look after the kids. We have a little, I have a little place in the Cape Flats, which is as poor as poor can be. We call it Velo Kaya. Velo is obviously French for bicycle. Kaya is a Zulu for place of where you live. So it's French bicycle place of where you live. And these kids are wonderful. We built them a BMX track. We got the sponsors. And I dug the first turf back in 2006. And I remember the conversation I had. I made the speech. And we had these kids lined up in the best looking Leica you could imagine. They looked fabulous. And it was a BMX. It wasn't anything worse than that. We had the track ready to build now. Spade was in the ground. This was it. And I had the kids. I said, one of you kids, there's 15 of them at the time, one of you kids, I will commentate on BMX, as it happens on Channel 9, when we go to the London Olympics in 2012. Now, this is 2006. Bloody hell, they got two riders there in Beijing in 2008. And one crashed 100 meters to go in the final in the bronze medal position, and he came fourth. And that kid will be back in London. But how good was that? All because they got the facilities. And Paul has a similar story. He'll tell you about the Bikes for Humanity, where these crate loads of bikes are being sent now into Uganda for the kids.
Yeah, well, a small charity I'm involved with. It's amazing to believe that in the United States and Canada, they throw 10 million bikes away into the tip every year. And 5 or 6 years ago, I got involved with a chap from Canada called Pat Montani, and he came up with the idea of collecting these bikes and sorting them out and figuring out which were still usable. He's been sending them to Namibia, to Zambia, and I was involved since the onset. And I said, well, hey, I live in Uganda. Why don't we send them to Uganda? The northern part of Uganda, there's a place called Karamoja. And this year, stuff is never easy in Africa, especially when it comes to customs and customs clearance. We attempted to bring some bikes, and it ended up that it was going to cost more than the value of the bikes and the container for the taxes, so we sent the container back. This year, we finally managed to get some support from the government, and we sent two containers with 1,000 bicycles right up into the north of Uganda and distributed them into one of the villages to help people get mobility, for the teachers to get to schools, for the health workers to get out into the villages and look after people. We've got three more containers on the way, and we're looking to take 25,000 bikes to northern Uganda in the next 3 years. And just before I came down here, I don't know if anybody has heard of the name of Ben Stiller, who did a movie called Zoolander, did a night at the museum. He's actually decided to help us, and he just donated $50,000 for the next three containers.
That's brilliant.
To answer the question about cycling and the sport, in the next country to me, a country called Rwanda, which has been through a lot of turmoil, the first American to ride the Tour de France, Jack Boyer, came down to look at these kids who were transporting coffee beans on wooden bicycles. And he was amazed at the power of these guys. So he said, right, I think I'll stay down here and start to train with a few guys. And he's actually built up a Rwandan cycling team who are riding around the continent at the moment. And in fact, they've got one of the young black cyclists who's riding for the MTN-sponsored team in South Africa. And very shortly, I reckon he'll be on the international circuit, because we actually watched him race against Lance Armstrong in the Tour of Ireland a couple of years ago. This year, there will be an Eritrean rider on the international circuit riding for one of the World Tour teams. So Africa, slowly but surely, is starting to produce those cyclists. There's lots of races around Africa, the Tour of Burkina Faso, which is done on dirt roads. There's the Tour of Eritrea. There's many, many well-organized races in South Africa, but it's starting to come up through the whole of the continent. And it won't be too long before we have some black cyclists riding in the Tour de France. And I can say that because I live there, and that's how we describe the color of our brethren.
In fact, you may have noticed that Jay Ryan has got two other ambitions. One is to bring forward an African cyclist on Green Edge, even though he wants the all-Australian success. And the other one is he is looking desperately. I flew in with him on Saturday. He told me he wants to find a Chinese cyclist to ride on the team. I went to the first Tour of Beijing this year, and the five Chinese amateur cyclists were put in against the pros, the big pros, same field that's here, and I saw the pros helping these kids. They got into breakaways, and they told them exactly how to ride, and I told the story to Jerry. The African kid he's got is Daniel Tekle-Haimeno. Now, nobody in Australia can say his name, so he's Dan X. But anyway, he's a great kid, and he speaks French first language, but he speaks very good English, and he's totally accepted by the team. I've asked the riders how good he is on the bike, and they rate him highly. Well, I tell you, I've looked at his legs, and the veins on his legs are just about the same as the veins on the body of American. They looked exactly the same. Both were fantastic athletes. And I think Daniel will be a very good cyclist. I think the Asians will beat the Africans to a first all professional team, and it's still a few years away. But they're already coming through now, believe me. It is a worldwide sport, and it's a worldwide pastime as well, because On March the 11th this year, the what they call the Argus, Cape Argus is the newspaper, Pick and Pay is the sponsoring, like Coles or Kmart. They've done it since 1978, and this event has had a top limit now, 38,000 cyclists. Cape Town now close all of their streets. I feel sorry for the people who want to leave town on a Sunday. It's impossible to find the way out, but they close the whole Cape Peninsula. And 38,000 cyclists take for their ride around the front-end race. The first prize is $2,000, $20,000, right? So it's a good race at the front. Starts at 6:15. You've got to be home by 5 o'clock in the evening. Those roads are closed all that time. Cycling is big money for everybody concerned now. They raised $2.1 million for charities on that one day. Any more short questions?
Well, the questions are short. The answers might be a bit
on
long.
On the left, yeah. Overall, you mean? Before they climb the hill? It's 3 kilometres, isn't it? They climb it once, and the second time up, it's all or nothing.
It's going to be
half a minute.
Half a minute. It's going to be a completely different tone to Wollongong Hill, because when you climb it and you know that the finish is going to be 10 kilometres away, you, as a guy like Andre Greipel or any of the other sprinters who will build up their advantage over the first few stages, you will hold a little bit back on Wollongong Hill, because you know that you need that energy to try and catch up on the descent. But I think that the likes of Matty Lloyd and the climbers, they're going to hit that hill the final time in a different way than they've ever hit it before in the past. So it'll be interesting to see. And we've got the advantage of being able to witness that live on Channel 9 at the weekend. And that, I think, is going to be a fantastic day of racing and a fantastic day of television.
I can't see Andre winning the race, personally. I think the hill will be too steep for him at the speed they'll hit it. You get somebody like Matthew Lloyd, who weighs 52 kilos, he's like a rabbit, and he just scurry up the hill, and Simon Gerrans as well. The secret weapons is we don't know the form of some of the riders. This is a perfect race for Luis Leon Sanchez, for example, but we don't know how fit he is. Oh, he looks pretty fit. Or Michael Matthews, the Aussie, who is the under-23 world champion. He's on Rabobank, another good guy. And I know Green Edge are pinning their hopes on Gerrans. They're putting a lot of pressure on O'Grady because, you know, he's getting close to the end of his career. This is his big dream, is to win the race again. And Cameron Meyer, last year's winner. And so they've got three chances. So they'll go out open-minded. They'll just see, they'll look on Friday and see where these three guys overall. Then they'll go to the other two and say, right, it's Gerrans, or you work for Meyer. And that's it now. We've laid our cards, and we've got one man left to attack the rest of the race with. But this is an interesting course. Mike Tertius listened to the riders, who wanted it to be made a little bit harder, but they didn't want it to be excruciating because their season's not even started back home. So we've got the extra lap at Stirling, and that's a lovely circuit at Stirling. I'm not saying that because Peter's here from the council. He's claiming the start in Lobetal as well now, so that means a glass of wine at each end. I think it's fantastic. But I think it's a beautiful area, the Adelaide Hills, and that extra lap will be absolutely fantastic. And Stirling's a great town as well. And for those who don't know, it's one of the few places where you can see the white-winged chough, which is a blackbird with white tips on its wing and a white beak, and it's just around the corner. I went with a bird watcher there to see those, and they always stay in the same place. They might have to move for the race this year. And then we've got the climb over Menglis Hill, I think it is. I think it's Menglis Hill when we go to Tanunda. So, and it's nearer the end, so it could be more crucial. The guys won't just struggle as a peloton. There could be moves to win the day. So there is room to gain time. But this race, if you look at the over the 14 years, 13 years so far, it's always won it by as little as 1 second or even same time, down to about 30 to 45 seconds. Once or twice it's been won by more than a minute. So I still think it'll be a battle of seconds. But whoever is in the lead on the Saturday night will win the race for sure. Gosh. Yes. Oh, thank you. Have you got a telephone number? No, okay. Gosh. Australia has a lot of good young riders, and I have to say the UK has two now. Geraint Thomas, I think, who's riding here. I think he'll be a very big name in the next 2 years. Mark Cavendish will continue being the top sprinter for a little while. We've got a new kid from West Australia. You may have seen him. He was on Channel 10 for 2 hours yesterday. He won two of the four stages. Pardon?
Channel 9.
No, Channel 10. That's a different story.
I wasn't sorry. I
think the Channel 10, we put 2 hours on the Bay Classic series, and we discovered this 17-year-old kid. He's the World Junior Omnium Champion, which is a rubbish event. Not for him. He's great, but how the hell will ever explain that in the Olympics? I don't know. He won it, and he was too young to take part in the under-23 national championships in Buninyong, and he'd have won it. He is such an incredible sprinter. He beat the likes of Baden Cook, Greg Henderson, all the top sprinters, Robbie McEwen, on two occasions. He comes from West Australia. He's 17 years of age, and he talks like a man of 23. He doesn't recognize reputation. So in long term, that could be another top Australian, but he'll be a sprinter. He won't be a tour winner. Tour winners is not so easy to pick. I think Michael Matthews can possibly be a great one-day rider. I don't think he's going to win the tour. But then we said the same about Armstrong pre-cancer. After his operation, he came back and he won the tour 7 times. His body shape was totally different.
I think the difference is when I turned professional, there was Phil Anderson spoke English. There was Sean Kelly and myself. There were not too many English-speaking guys around. What Australia has done with the Institute for Sport, obviously with a lot of different sports, but they've put a foundation in to build up a lot of talented athletes. The Great Britain's done the same thing with British cycling, and we've built up. The Australians and the Brits for a long time were not a force to be reckoned with when it came to the Olympic Games, when it came to track cycling, And I think with putting that foundation in both of our countries, what we've done is put together a base for a lot, especially the endurance track cyclists, is to go on to greater things. And I have to say, when Phil and I look at guys like Geraint Thomas at the Tour de France, who come from a track background, when you look at most of the successful Australian cyclists on the Tour de France, a lot of them have also come from the endurance program at the track. It's the ability to have that training in the early part of your career allows these guys to transfer from being great pursuers, being great distance riders on the track, to then using that same kind of effort when you go through to the big mountains of the Tour de France. So I think we, as the English-speaking cycling world, have got a great future ahead of us. We've seen Cadel win the World Professional Road Racing Championships, and now we've seen Mark Cavendish win the World Professional Road Racing Championships. I think the English-speaking world are now becoming a force to be reckoned with, and the French are starting to end up being a long way behind us. And we did beat them in the World Cup as well with the Kiwis, didn't we, I think?
Oh, the French had never beaten the English in any
of the What a terrible game that was. 9-8.
Pursuiting, it's like asking a 100-meter sprinter in athletics to suddenly be a marathon runner. It never happens, but in cycling it can happen. Even when we go back into the old days, Ferdy Brakker of Belgium was a world pursuit champion over 4,000 metres. He rode the Tour de France. He finished fourth. It's an incredible opposite end of the body and the technology required to do such a thing. So that's why cycling is very exciting. As far as the Olympics go, of course, they're in London. It's the first time my expense account will say tube fare when I go to the event every day. But it's just down the road from my house. It'll be a battle. The cycling will be a battle between Great Britain and Australia, with a minor intrusion from New Zealand, who are coming strong, from Germany possibly, and from France. But everybody else won't get a look in the cycling on the track. On the road, it's a bit of a lottery, and there'll be definitely a bigger combination there. But I think we're going to see some terrific battles, because the Brits, let's face it, annihilated everybody in Beijing. Shocked us. But it was brilliant to see, because at last I was proud to be British, but I was working for the Aussies, so I had to play it down. And we only got one silver medal. And as you know, Aussies love sport only when they're winning. And every time I went back to the international broadcast centre, well, what went wrong? I said, well, they weren't so good. And in the end, Anna Mears, who'd just come back from a near-death accident in Los Angeles about less than a year previously, she got the only medal for the Aussie track team, a silver. She saved the day for everybody. But it'll be a totally different result in London. The two countries now are so locked together in ability. And even Bradley Wiggins, only this morning, I think it was this morning I read it, has said that Cameron Meyer will be one of the finest bike riders in the world and very difficult to beat in the team's pursuit in London. And he's right. Cameron, you saw him last night. He got to the front. He wears number one as this year, last year's winner of the Santos Tour Down Under. And he got to the front, and he just sat there, those big legs just pounding out a rhythm, and he closed that breakaway right down to try and set it up for green edge. Didn't get the result, but he did his job well.
Yeah, we were actually talking last night after the program. I think looking at guys like Cameron Meyer and Geraint Thomas, it's a it's going to be a really difficult year this year for the young guys coming through, because they've still got that speed and that ability to try and win an Olympic gold medal, but they still want to ride the Tour de France. Mm. It's a hard decision to make for a lot of those young guys this year, to decide whether they miss out on the Tour de France and go for the Olympic medal. For the Brits, it's even harder, because, you know, only once in your career will you get a chance of riding Olympic Games in your home country. And it'll be interesting to see what sort of decisions the guys like Cameron Meyer, guys like Geraint Thomas, what decision they're going to make when it comes up to actually participating in the Tour de France, or missing it and going on to ride the Olympic Games.
It's a horrible year for the top cyclists, because you see, the public, all eyes are on the Olympic Games. Winning a gold medal means an awful lot in your country. But to a professional cyclist, winning the Tour de France is far more valuable to them. But the boys know which side the bread's buttered, so people like Mark Cavendish, Bradley Wiggins have got to fly the flag for Great Britain 6 days after the Tour de France finishes. And that's a real tough call. They may have to make a decision at some stage to leave the Tour with a week to go, just according to the way the body feels. Because if they leave the Tour feeling tired, they'll never recover for the following week's Olympic road race. It's impossible. So they must leave the Tour feeling strong, and then they'll be almost unbeatable. Yep. It's easy when you're a commentator sat here. It's no problem at all. Yeah. The funny thing is that over the years, cyclists have never looked at the prize list. It's a result for their achievements, and then they've got their salary off the teams. But now I think they do, because now we've got all these the World Tour teams, and there's only 20 of them, and they've got to ride the World Tour events. But even so, there's a level of payment that has to be provided, a level of transport which has to be provided. The first prize in the Tour de France, I think, is about $300,000 US, isn't it? First prize. That's the individual prize. It'll be overall nearly a 2 million prize list in dollars or euros. But whoever wins the money in the team doesn't get the money. I mean, Nathan Haas last night won 1,500 euros. He was on fire pinching those lap prizes. But that goes in the hat. The accountant then divides it. You look who rode that particular race. Maybe Nathan will get 50% as a Christmas bonus, and the other 100,000 euros will go into the pot, and then so much will go, because they cut in the mechanics and the soigneurs. Everybody's made that a team. Again, this is something, because you know, Paul, each team devises their own system, don't they? It's not all written down.
It's pretty much, if you win the Tour de France, you're not going to take any money out of the prize pot. But to bring it back to your question, for example, a team that wins the Tour de France and wins a bunch of stages and maybe well placed in the team prize, they're probably going to take home $600,000 or $700,000. I think that's ridiculous for an effort of almost a month. I went to a small golf tournament.
It's 3 weeks' pay for Wayne Rooney.
I went to what the soccer players get paid. I went to a golf tournament, 3 days, in a little island called Hilton Head Island, just off South Carolina. The guys played Friday, Saturday, Sunday. The winner was a guy called Davis Love III, and he walked home with $3 million for 3 days as opposed to 3 weeks. But cycling has changed. It has evolved. The salaries have changed. I mean, when Bernard Hinault won the Tour de France, and you could talk to Eddie Merckx about when he raced, he didn't know what $1 million was at the time. Bernard Hinault was getting paid £35,000 a year when he turned professional. Then all of a sudden, an American guy by the name of Greg LeMond came along. He was the first guy that signed $1 million contract, but that wasn't for a year. It was $350,000 a year. And then the money started to come in, and the money has changed an awful lot. But for the effort that gets put in by these guys, I still don't think it reflects the amount of work that they have to put in. I thought I rode a lot of training throughout the years, and we in the era, and I'm talking 25 years ago, we used to do about 35,000 kilometers a year. I was talking to somebody just the other day, and they reckon that the guys, the top professionals now, including guys like Mark Cavendish, are doing between 45 and 55,000 kilometers a year. You don't do that in your car, I don't think. And if you do, you're probably paying a lot of insurance.
Mark's, we don't know the salaries. There is a structure, but it's always in the contracts. I would think Mark's probably basic salary is around 1 to 1.5 million euros a year now, which is £1 million, which is not bad for a kid of 25 years of age. He has an expensive girlfriend, but that's not bad, is it? And then there's the bonuses. There's the side deals with doing certain equipment, wearing certain shoes, etc., which sometimes is not allowed because the team has other deals and that will take priority, and so it gets very complex. But I think for the effort and the way that they're totally 100% dedicated, a golfer or a tennis player or even an athlete, they have their set circuits. But a cyclist is expected, because of his reputation, to win everything he rides. And the only guy that could ever do that was Eddie Merckx, who's here this week and I must say enjoying himself immensely. But Eddie, because I was a journalist very much in his period, I said, they call you the cannibal. He goes, yes. I said, well, look, I always found it so boring when you were riding races. And then he scowls. Why? I said, because I used to bring my newspaper, which is the Daily Telegraph in London. They'd say, well, who won? I said, well, Eddie Merckx won. He said, that guy's always winning. Because there's no appreciation of the athletic prowess. It would, if Wayne Rooney scored a goal every day, that'd be fine. We'll make it the lead story. But not if you win a bike race every day. So I said, Eddie, if you win every day, I only got a small amount of space in the paper. If you got beaten, that was a great story. I could write a lot more. And I said, so why didn't you lose occasionally? He looked at me and said, because the people came to see me win. And so I must win. That's all he said. I must win her. And I said, okay. And he did win. And, you know, he's famous. Eddie Merckx is famous for whenever a race started, jumps off, checks his saddle, gets back on, catches the race up. He went out for a ride yesterday. Somebody had loaned him a very nice bike, brand new. And he went out for a ride with Pat Yonker, who won this race back in 2003 or 4. No, it wasn't 3, but anyway, whenever it was. And Pat said, Eddie was at the front, and the boys at the back were shouting for him to slow down. If you see Eddie, he's pretty heavy now. And then Eddie would suddenly pull off on the road, stop, check his saddle height with his spanner he carried with him. They said he stopped 20 times to check his saddle height. This is exactly what he did when he was a top racing cyclist. I found it absolutely fascinating. And then he'd get back on the bike and go flat out again. They were not even in the saddle before he'd gone down the road, and they were chasing him, and then he'd stop again and check it again. And he takes life very... I told him the story when we were waiting for the team presentation. He goes, no, it wasn't me. I said, yeah, right. So that's Eddie Merckx. He's the most interesting character I think you'll ever meet. His proudest moment, he was telling us last night again, just before we started the team presentation. He was given the highest possible honour to a foreigner by France on December the 18th last year, which was he became a commander of the Légion d'honneur. And he's only the second Belgian to receive it. And he said it was fantastic. His whole family were invited. His son Axel came in with a wife from Canada. Everybody went to the Elysee Palace. And he says, normally you just won in a big group of people, which is true. And Eddie was ready to go, but the family couldn't be there. And Sarkozy, the president, who actually is a cycling fan big time, couldn't make that particular one to do the investiture. So he asked Eddie if he changed the date. And Eddie said he had a private audience. It was totally by himself with the family. And Sarkozy personally gave him the commander of the Légion d'honneur. So, and Eddie, you could see by the way he was talking, was very pleased. Because he's not a man of words. If he's bored, he says, I go now. And he'd gone. But I can see the way he's so relaxed here in Adelaide. He's just loving the place. He's looking forward very much to going to the wineries. And he's also doing the ride on Friday, so watch out. You'll know when he goes past. Yeah. Right, well, I'm not very technical, as you probably know, because I always give these questions to Paul. I'll only tell you my two favourite stories is that it won Greg LeMond the Tour de France back in 89 because he was allowed to use the tri-shaped bars invented by Boone Lennon. And Bernard Hinault was the man who tested those famous cleat pedals like ski bindings, which have become the thing to have. The other great advancement for me was the changing of the gears by moving the brake levers because the guys can't see your hands moving to the gear lever. So you could always flick your gears, and you could change them out of the saddle as well, which was also good. But I don't know about you, Paul, I'm sure you agree. Technology now with the lightness of the bicycles, I mean, the Green Edge bikes, I rode Pseudo Grady's bike for 2 weeks in Victoria before Stuart received it down here, because he was down here. And the electronic gears, unbelievable. The batteries last 2,000 hours. It's bloody bad luck if they're about to expire when you're riding because they fail safe in top gear. And if you're climbing a hill, you'll kill yourself. But all being well, you just touch the levers and the change of the gears, even the front chain wheels, are so positive. And the noise goes zip, zip. It's just the technology for me is special. And this is why the UCI have created rules to stop the bicycle winning the races and not the human being on it, right?
Yeah, I think one of the incredible things is the composites that have been used. In the old days, it was the bike was made for the rider. Each individual frame was made for the rider. But nowadays, with the geometry, the frames are pretty much all the same, and it's actually the position of the handlebars and the saddle and all the attachments that actually get the rider's position right on the machine. And it's quite amazing the way you can almost walk into, almost anybody in the room here can walk into a bike shop and buy a top-of-the-range professional racing cycle, almost the same as Stewie O'Grady or any of the guys in this bike race. They're almost exactly the same. And although it's not been really reflected in the prices, it should be because it's much easier now to mass manufacture the bikes. But it still puts the price, pushes the prices up to $10,000 to $14,000 for the top of the range stuff.
They can be with all the gears, indeed. I'll tell you one little funny story, because I've known many cyclists, even at the level of Tour de France riders, on the handlebars. You know, you have to undergo a flying school these days to understand everything on your bike. But you get these Garmin calculators with wires and cables, are checking your cadence, checking your heart rate, checking how fast you're going, checking the altitude, how far you just climbed. I don't know how they ever get down to racing the bike, really. But some of the guys readjust the heart rate, so it doesn't read the heart rate correctly. They calibrate it differently, and you get a rider look across at the Garmin and see this guy's climbing a mountain, his heart rate's 49. And it should be around 190. And they think, God, this guy's going well, and before you know it, that guy's gone off the back, and the other fellas doesn't... He probably was beating at 200. I mean, I heard that story connected to Miguel Indurain in the years gone by. I was always away. When I used to race, not very well, a guy used to whistle alongside me climbing hills. He asked me if it put me off. I said, no, I'm enjoying the tune. So he said, oh, I'll stop.
But to come back to the technology, not just the, as Phil was mentioned, the Garmin and heart rate monitors. I think the advent of heart rate monitors has been an incredible thing to allow riders to train a lot more precisely than we used to train in the old days. The doctor can load down the heart rate monitor into a computer at night and see how the riders are recovering. But the majority of the big stars, they don't look at their heart rate monitors when they're actually getting into the professional bike race. We had a great British rider a while ago, and we used to try and interview him at the finish of the race. His name was Chris Boardman. So you'd ask him why he got dropped on one of the mountain stages. Well, my heart rate went down by 32.7%. My cadence was off by 5%, and I was just wishing he could just say I got dropped because I was knackered, but he never would. But most of the guys, when it comes to even we debate race radios very often, and even when it comes down to race radios and heart rate monitors, when it comes down to the moment of the kill, Cadel Evans. When he came down to that moment when he had to ride for himself on the stage up to the Galibier, forget about the race radio, forget about the heart rate monitor. It's all in there.
Absolutely.
It's all in there. It's in the guts. And that's what brings cycling right back down to the people. It's none of that technology. It's the man himself at the end of the day has to do it. Even if he's got the best bike in the world, it's the man himself has to do it.
It is, because Stuart O'Grady's bike wasn't going as fast last week as it is this week, I can tell you. It's absolutely the bottom line. It's in the mind, and kids ask me all the time how they can be as good as Miguel, and Eddie said it yesterday to us. I asked him on television, it's not come on air yet, but it will do, saying, Eddie, why were you so good, so different to everybody else? And he went, well, I was born with the talent, which is true, but that doesn't mean you can produce that talent. You can't get it out because you haven't got it here. And Eddie says, and I trained very, very hard, and he did. He would look at the weather. He'd ride out in the snow. He'd train 8 hours, and he'd be a strong man. Armstrong did the same. 60% is your brain and application. That's why people like Jens Voigt, who's here now, he's hit 40, who believes he was joking on the stage yesterday, he wants the UCI to grant him a professional license till he's 50. If he keeps his same rate of enthusiasm, his body will do it. It's the mind that stops. Suddenly you realize you die going around a corner at 100 kilometers an hour, whereas 18-year-old, it's not possible to die. You just go. And so it's all in the mind. If he still thinks he's 18, he's got a good chance. I think he does think he's 18 as a father. He's got 6 kids now.
Yeah, no, these
it's
are the
funny
old
you
ones,
should
actually.
Say that, but can you get him discount because he's leaving here to go and buy a black pair?
I'm actually very, very embarrassed to be wearing brown RMs with the dark trousers. I wasn't expecting to wear the dark trousers until the end of the week, which would have given me a week to get down to the RM Williams shop to get a black pair, which as soon as lunch is over, I'm going across to Rundle Mall, turning left to the shop there, and if you see me later on this afternoon, I'll have the black ones on.
It's true. And the sun.
I've got 5 pair at home as well.
The Sunday Mail in a fantastic TV Time supplement highlighting the race. Big story on Paul. Arlen Williams got more mentions than the Santos Tour Down Under, so I reckon they should send him a pair.
Are there any more? Does anyone have any final questions? Yes, another one over here.
It's a good question. It's not the one particularly that the English-speaking world understands the best, but I think... I really don't know how to answer this. I don't know which one I would prefer to own. Both, of course, Goodella's got. But Paul and I have a thing. We see these kids riding around in a rainbow jersey or a maillot jaune. I could never do that unless it was mine and earned and won. They're both very special.
I like Phil, I disagree with them selling replica jerseys for people to ride around them, because I still believe it's a fairly sacred thing. When you talk about an Olympic gold medal, you talk about the yellow jersey or the green jersey at the Tour de France, it's a great jersey to win, but the special thing about the rainbow jersey is you wear that every day for the year that you are the world champion. You wear it at every event that you're at. And every event that you're at wearing that jersey, you get pointed at by the public. In Europe, it is still a huge thing. And it was great to see Cadel, because we always talk about the curse of the rainbow jersey. And most guys who've won it have a terrible year the following year with the rainbow jersey on their backs. Cadel had a great year as the world champion and the reigning world champion. And he defended it incredibly in a place where it was very difficult to defend on home turf in front of a home ground. It's going to be interesting for us this year to see a British rider. I don't remember Tom Simpson, but Tom Simpson was the last guy to win the rainbow jersey for Great Britain. And to see Cavendish this year in that jersey is going to be quite special, I think.
No, it is. And Mark, there's no doubt he's won 20 stages now at the Tour de France. But the way he's talking about his arc-en-ciel, his rainbow jersey, it's very, very special to him, and he can't wait to ride in it. And I think he'll honour it too. I think he'll have a great season. And isn't it nice to go to the Olympic Games wearing a rainbow jersey? It'd be fantastic.
One last one.
I know. It's. I get battered by the women every year. I look forward to that, but apart from that... women's cycling for me now is terrific, but it's very hard. They want equality in their salaries, but it is such a hard sport. Their bodies simply won't allow them to do what the men can do, and the viewers turn off and say, look, they're going 20k an hour slower than the men. It's very unfair, because women's cycling does have good sponsored teams around the world. Green Edge will go in and mix it with them right now. And Australia has some terrific women cyclists. I mean, new ones coming through. Chloe Hosking and Melissa Hoskins. Amanda Spratt has just won the title. I know she's a bit older, but she's a great title, a great talent. And Rachel Rossell Gilmore, rather, who is coming back from a crash, the Commonwealth Games champion. And they are really performing well around the world, but I feel very sorry. And it's happening here, too. We're not giving them any publicity. With the Tour Down Under and the riding here, and it was a good race yesterday, because waiting to go on air, we were watching it on television and we saw it all in a very aggressive race, and they love the chance of performing in front of the crowds, but it's a battle, and I don't have the answers, but I've seen them race well. I'm torn. I don't like to see a girl get bashed up in a major crash on a bike. I just don't like to see it, but on the other hand, I can understand why they want to do it. My wife rides. She's been riding with me this morning. It's the only thing that stops her talking. It's absolutely amazing. Yeah. Well, having said that, it doesn't. I can hear her down the peloton talking, and I'm out of breath thinking, oh, for Christ's sake, shut up. I'm getting up the next hill here. But then we go up Norton Summit, and it's absolutely serene. Yeah.
Thank you very much. As usual, that was wonderfully entertaining for all of us, and I think informative at the same time. Normally, it's traditional for us to give our guests a bottle of Jacob's Creek Reserve, but Phil explained to us, I think it was last year or so, that he's never been able to take the wine home because of the hand luggage rules on planes and things. It's quite difficult. So this year, we went to Paul's favourite shop, R.M. Williams, and so we have... a gift from us from there. So all of us, let's thank our guests.
Thank you so much. Well, all I can say is that I told Jerry Ryan I was going to get the wine and to keep a hole in the cellar, so what am I going to tell him now? Thank you very much, Megan. Thank you.
I've been trying to get Liggett into a pair of R.M. Williams boots for 26 years, and I think I've finally done it.
just, I may as well do the raffle because I'm conscious that some people do have to go. So, Isabel, if I could ask you to come and help me do the raffle. So this is the first prize, which is for the jewellery voucher.
Blue ticket, A29.
Oh. What are you doing? Here we go. And this is for the carton of beer from James Bowes. Oh, another one.
Blue ticket, A82. Marion Cox.
Yes.
Martin Cox.
This is for the wine.
Green ticket, A4M Kirk.
There you go. And this is for the R. M. Williams bag.
Blue ticket, A21.
A21. Oh, very lucky, Tegel. Thank you, Isabel. Thank you, everybody. That's the end of the formalities for today. Thank you for attending. And just a reminder, Isabel's here on March the 16th, which is what day of the week is it? I can't remember either. All we know is it's 2 years basically until the state election, so she's here drawing a line in the sand, perhaps. We'll see. Thank you very much. Yeah.